This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. This week, the U.S. announced it will impose steel tariffs on Canada, Mexico, and the EU. The hope was to wring concessions out of our trading partners, but they do not appear to be backing down. Plus, 8 states hold primary elections on Tuesday. Everybody's watching California. We'll see why. And Mike Pompeo has been dining with North Korean leaders to try to reset a summit conference. We'll talk about this and more with the political junkie Ken Rudin, who joins me right now. Hello, Ken.
Hello, Frank.
Let's start with the breaking news, though. A presidential pardon of Dinesh D'Souza, conservative commentator. Tell us more.
Well, you know, something that's very interesting. Obviously, the president has problems with the justice system. He's indicated that from the beginning. And he's decided to deal with his politics of grievances by pardoning people he obviously has a kinship with. Dinesh D'Souza is a very conservative commentator who's actually, some of his rants and tweets have gone from conservative to racist. He called Barack Obama a boy in one of his more infamous tweets. And Dinesh D'Souza was on Fox and Friends this morning talking about what a great man the president is. But basically, I think what the president is doing, he's sending a signal to people like Michael Cohen, to Paul Manafort, to others, to say, look, don't say anything. Stay quiet, because whatever Robert Mueller does, I will pardon you. And I kind of think it's a signal, basically, to these people just to stay quiet and not come forward.
Yeah, and it raises questions about whether that's legal. Presidents have the right to pardon, but whether or not they can pardon people who are embroiled in the very prosecution that he might face for his own criminal wrongdoing, should he be indicted or should he be charged and should criminal charges be appropriate. You know, there's a question about whether or not you can pardon people involved in your own criminal prosecution.
Frank, everything I've read, and I've read a lot about this, everything seems to indicate it's illegal. It stinks. It is legal. I would say it stinks, but it seems to be legal. I mean, a lot of people talk about the Bill Clinton pardon of Mark Rich, but again, that was after the fact. As you say, a lot of these people, the Manaforts, the Michael Cohns, are involved in current investigations. But that doesn't stop the president from issuing a pardon.
Another potential pardon, and again, kind of indicating the president's willingness and penchant for sticking it to his enemies and using his high office to do that. A Martha Stewart pardon is perhaps in the works.
Isn't that something? I mean, the only reason I could think of him wanting to pardon Martha Stewart is the fact that it was James Comey who prosecuted her. They're talking about the president pardoning Rod Blagojevich, the former governor of Illinois, and the only reason I could see that happening too is that he was prosecuted by Patrick Fitzgerald, who's a good friend of James Comey. And Dinesh D'Souza, as we said in the beginning, he was prosecuted by Preet Bharara, the U.S. attorney, whom President Trump fired last year. So this almost seems to be like a combination of the politics of vengeance and the politics of personal grievances, and this is vintage Donald Trump.
All right. Yesterday, the Trump administration announced it's going ahead with those steel and aluminum tariffs against our allies, Canada, Mexico, and the EU. As of midnight, they went into effect. Tell us more about that, because the hope was, of course, they would back down and make concessions. They have not done that yet.
No, and they probably won't. And not only will they probably won't, they're ready to impose sanctions on their own. And if anything, this is going to backfire. It sounds like it's going to backfire on U.S. farmers, U.S. consumers, and U.S. economy. Look, the president, in the art of the deal, talked about his great deal-making and how he would either bully or pressure the opponents into making concessions. And he's done that, basically he's tried to do that with these steel and aluminum tariffs it was China. I mean, the president from day one has talked about how China has manipulated its currency, its unfair trade practices. It was China that's the enemy, and yet the president is imposing tariffs on Canada, Mexico, the European Union, our allies. So the message that's coming out is whether the United States is a trustworthy trade partner and ally. It's the allies, it's the U.S. allies who seem to be the target of these tariffs, and of course they are going to respond in kind. And as I said, it could backfire on the U.S.
Well, as you say, in terms of policy, it generates the one thing that all business people hate, which is uncertainty. At the political level, Republicans generally are on record as hating tariffs. And as you say, it's going to raise prices on everything, not only the cost of importing when the imports are more costly and they go into U.S.-produced products. That's going to raise the price. And then if there's retaliation, that will raise prices. And we'll probably see some job loss as a result of those industries that are affected by higher import costs. So
absolutely.
Hard to know who's the winner in this.
Well, not the United States. Certainly nobody seems to be the winner. And maybe the winner is China, because they seem to be the ones that are untouched by this. But when Mexico was talking about retaliating by putting tariffs on pork and apples and cheese, well, it's U.S. dairy farmers, it's U.S. cattle producers, it's those people who are suffering the price. And if Trump is going to impose tariffs on automobiles imports, it's Germany and Japan, our allies, who will pay the price the most. So it just seems so counterintuitive, but actually everything is counterintuitive.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's it. One of the questions is whether or not the pain, again, for those farmers, for instance, and their lowered exports now that they'll see fewer exports, the higher prices, the job loss, whether all that really has an effect by November. And speaking of November, we've got 8 primaries coming up Tuesday. And, you know, we've got governor's races in Iowa and South Dakota, but really all eyes are in California right now, right?
There's no question it's on California for 2 reasons. First of all, they have this very interesting system, the top two system, where all the candidates, regardless of party, are on the same ballot, and the top two finishers, regardless of party, advance to November. Now, that sounds like it could hurt the Republicans in statewide races, because it looks like that it could be, you know, 2 Democrats who finish on top for the Senate, 2 Democrats who finish on top for governors. But if the Democrats are going to win control of Congress, of the House, in November, they have to start in places like California. There are at least 7 or 8 very vulnerable districts where Republican incumbents or open seats could favor the Democrats. But since, like, for example, there are several districts where there are like 15 Democratic candidates running for the same district, for the same seat. So if 15 Democrats split up their vote and only 2 Republicans are running in that district, it's very possible that in these vulnerable Republican districts, there won't be a Democratic candidate in November, because they'll be eating each other alive in the June 5th primary. So this top two finish thing that a lot of people thought might help the Democratic Party could wind up hurting them in the end. And we'll see what happens on Tuesday.
Yeah, but it is interesting, because Democrats, in some cases, the Democratic Party has weighed in, asking some candidates to stand down. But this does suggest, I mean, you're right. I mean, here you have a flooded field that could split the vote. And if all that happens, you know, it could work against them. On the other hand, this is really the crisis point for the Democrats, right? This top-down kind of erroneous policy that has caused them so much grief since 2016 and before. And a kind of a surge from the bottom up that has been kind of counter what the establishment has said. Is a little bit of that in play here?
Well, there are certainly divisions in the Democratic Party. There are divisions that there are some people who feel that the Democratic establishment, whatever that means, should step in these primary contests and decide who are the most viable Democratic candidates. But there are progressives and other groups, Bernie Sanders supporters, people like that, and said, look, let's let the people decide. Let's not do what the Republicans are doing. Let's make this a true small D Democratic process. And so you have a lot of these races where the Democratic establishment is trying to force these Democratic candidates out of the race. And there's resentment in the Democratic Party about this kind of intrusion. And the irony of all this is that in 7 of these House seats in California, all 7 of them are the ones that are most watched. Hillary Clinton carried each district, every district in 2016, giving ostensibly the Democrats a chance to win the seats in November, but not if they eat each other alive on Tuesday.
A lot of reasons to watch these races. Roseanne Barr, barred from ABC because of her racist tweet. She actually insults an entire race of people, and Donald Trump says he's the one who should get the apology.
Isn't that something? I mean, this is so remarkable. I mean, the funniest thing is that Sarah Sanders was asked early, is the president going to weigh in on Roseanne's racist tweet? And she says, no, he has bigger things to do. And then, lo and behold, he sends out a tweet and says, well, why is ABC apologizing to Valerie Jarrett for what Roseanne said? They should be apologizing to me for all the terrible things they've said about me. I think this is come as a shock to your audience, Frank, but I think a lot of what Donald Trump says is a lot about Donald Trump.
When now,
you heard it here first.
Okay, well, let me take a note. This is the 1st of June, 2018. It is fascinating to see how all of this plays out. We're going to talk about that. I've got about 30 seconds left. Let's talk about Korea, an effort to reset, probably try to get this thing going by June 12th. That time, the sands of time are ticking. Sands don't tick, actually.
It could happen. You know, the thought of Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un, the thought of them getting together and Donald Trump succeeding where previous administrations like George W. Bush and Barack Obama and Bill Clinton failed. Look, the problem is, one, the United States government is not united on this. Pompeo and John Bolton, the NSA, National Security Advisor, see different things about North Korea. There's a lot of talk about denuclearization in the peninsula, but Kim Jong-un is not going to give up nuclear weapons just because the United States is promising end of sanctions. So, yes, it looks like they will be sitting down on June 12th, if not later, but whether there'll be a real denuclearization of the peninsula is still up in the air.
Ken Rudin, the political junkie, as always, Ken, thank you so much.
It was more than 30 seconds, but thank you for
it. Was, and you can find out everything he said in the entire 12 minutes at our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, the Museum of Durham History celebrates one of the oldest Muslim communities in our state. We'll hear that on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Stay tuned.